fevered, his mind dazed with the waves of heat that throbbed over his body. And like the half-glimpsed things in fever dreams, he saw her naked flesh, pale and shimmering with sweat in the humid night, slick under John Gray's hand.
"We were both fucking you."
His back felt as though someone had laid a hot girdle on it. With a deep growl of exasperation, he turned onto his side again and fumbled at the bandages holding the scalding plaster to his skin, at last wriggling out of its torrid embrace. He dropped it on the floor and flung back the quilt that covered him, seeking the relief of cool air on body and mind. But the cabin was filled to the roof tree with the foggy warmth of fire and sleeping bodies, and the heat that flamed over him seemed to have rooted itself between his legs. He clenched his fists in the bedclothes, trying not to writhe, trying to calm his mind.
"Lord, let me stand aside from this," he whispered in Gaelic. "Grant me mercy and forgiveness. Grant me understanding."
What his mind presented him with instead was a fleeting sense, a memory of cold, as startling as it was refreshing. It was gone in a flash, but left his hand tingling with a touch of cold stone, cool earth, and he clung to the memory, closing his eyes, in imagination pressing his hot cheek to the wall of the cave. Because it was his cave, the place where he'd hidden, where he'd lived in the years after Culloden. He had throbbed there, too, pulsing with heat and hurt, rage and fever, desolation, and the sweet, brief consolation of dreams wherein he met his wife again. And he felt in mind the coldness, the dark chill that he'd thought would kill him, finding it now relief in the desert of his thoughts. He envisioned himself pressing his naked, scalded back to the rough damp of the cave wall, willing the coldness to pass into his flesh, to kill the fire. His rigid body eased a little, and he breathed slower, stubbornly ignoring the ripe reeks of the cabin, the fumes of horseradish and plum brandy and mustard, of cooking, and bodies washed infrequently. Trying to breathe the piercing cleanliness of the north wind, the scents of broom and heather. And what he smelled was...
"Mary," he whispered,
and his eyes flew open, shocked. The scent of green onions and cherries, not quite ripe, a cold boiled fowl, and the warm smell of a woman's flesh, faintly acrid with the sweat in her clothes, overlaid by the mild, fatty smell of his sister's lye soap. He took a deep breath as though he might capture more of it, but the cool air of the highlands had fled, and he inhaled a thick gulp of hot mustard and coughed.
"Aye, all right," he muttered ungraciously to God. "You've made your point."
He hadn't sought out a woman, even in his most abject loneliness, living in the cave. But when Mary MacNab had come to him on the eve of his departure for an English prison, he'd found consolation for his grief in her arms. Not as replacement for Claire, never that, but only desperately needing and gratefully accepting the gift of touch, of not being alone for a little while. How could he possibly find it wrong that Claire had done the same? He sighed, wriggling to find a more comfortable position. Little Chastity emitted a faint cry, and Sylvia Hardman sat up at once in a rustle of clothes, bending down to the cradle with a sleepy murmur. For the first time, the child's name struck him. The baby was perhaps 3 or 4 months old. How long had Gabriel Hardman been gone? More than a year, he thought, from what the little girls had said.
Chastity, indeed.
Was the name merely the natural companion to prudence and patience? Or Mrs. Hardman's private, poignant bitterness, a reproach to her missing husband? He closed his eyes and sought a sense of coolness in the dark. He thought he had burned long enough. Chapter 20. Of Cabbages and Kings. He walked to the road just before dawn, declining help from Prudence and Patience, though they insisted upon coming with him in case he should fall flat on his face, be stricken with sudden paralysis, or step into a gopher's hole and twist an ankle. They had no great opinion of his powers, but were well-mannered enough to keep a distance of a foot or so on either side, their hands hovering like small white butterflies near his elbows, pale in the half-dark.
"There's not so many wagons coming in these last few days," Patience observed, in a tone somewhere between anxiety and hope. "Thee may not find a suitable conveyance."
"I should be satisfied wi' a dung-cart or a wagon filled with cabbages," he assured her, already glancing down the road. "My business is somewhat urgent."
"We know," Prudence reminded him. "We were under the bed when Washington appointed you."
She spoke with a certain reserve, as a Quaker opposed to the practice of war, and he smiled at her small, serious face, long-lipped and kind-eyed like her mother's.
"Washington is nae my greatest concern," he said. "I must see my wife before anything else."
"Thee has not seen her in some time?" Prudence asked, surprised. "Why?"
"I was detained upon business in Scotland," he said, deciding not to observe that he'd seen her but 2 days ago. "Is that a wagon coming, d'ye think?"
It was a drover with a herd of swine, in fact, and they were obliged to scuttle back from the roadside with some haste in order to avoid being either bitten or trampled. By the time the sun was fully up, though, regular traffic had begun to flow along the road. Most of this was coming from Philadelphia, as the girls had told him. Loyalist families who couldn't afford to leave by ship, fleeing the city with what they could carry, some with wagons or handcarts, many with no more than what they could convey on their backs or in their arms. There were also British soldiers in groups and columns, presumably assisting the exodus and protecting the Loyalists from being attacked or looted should rebel militia suddenly come out of the wood. That thought reminded him of John Gray, who had been mercifully absent from his mind for several hours. Jamie ruthlessly pushed him out again, muttering, "Aye, stay gone," under his breath. But a reluctant second thought occurred to him. What if Gray had been released by the militia at once and had already made his way back to Philadelphia? On the one hand, he would see to Claire's safety. He could trust the man for that. But on the other... Aye, well, if he walked into the house and found Gray there with her, he'd just take her away with him and say nothing. Unless...
"Does thee still suffer from the horseradish, friend Jamie?" Patience asked politely. "Thee snorts quite fearful. Perhaps thee had best take my hanky."
In the woods outside Philadelphia. Gray woke abruptly to full daylight and a musket barrel jabbed into his belly.
"Come out of there with your hands up," said a cold voice.
He got his good eye sufficiently open as to see that his interlocutor wore a tattered Continental officer's coat over homespun breeches and an open-collared shirt, topped by a slouch hat turned up with a turkey feather through the brim. Rebel militia. Heart in his throat, he crawled stiffly out of his refuge and rose, hands in the air. His captor blinked at Gray's battered face, then at the fetters, strips of muslin bandage hanging from the rusted links. He withdrew the musket slightly but didn't lower it. Now that Gray was on his feet, he could see several other men as well, all peering at him with extreme interest.
Where did you escape from?" the officer with the musket asked carefully.
There were two possible answers, and he chose the riskier option. Saying jail would have likely led to them leaving him alone, or at worst, taking him with them, but leaving him in irons. Either way, he'd still be wearing fetters.
"I was put in irons by a British officer who took me up as a spy," he said boldly. "Entirely true," he reflected, "so far as it goes."
A deep hum of interest ran among the men who pressed closer to look at him, and the prodding musket barrel was withdrawn altogether.
"Indeed," said his captor, who had an educated English voice, with a slight Dorset accent. "And what might be your name, sir?"
"Bertram Armstrong," he replied promptly, using two of his middle names.
"And may I have the pleasure of knowing your own name, sir?"
The man pursed his lips a little, but answered readily enough.
"I am the Reverend Peleg Woodsworth, captain of the 16th Pennsylvania, sir. And your company?"
Gray saw Woodsworth's eyes flick towards his liberty cap with its bold motto.
"I haven't yet joined a company, sir," he said, softening his own accent just a little. "I was on my way to do so, in fact, when I ran afoul of a British patrol, and shortly thereafter found myself in the straits you see."
He raised his wrists a little, clanking. The hum of interest came again, this time with a distinct note of approval.
"Well then," Woodsworth said, and lifted his musket to his shoulder. "Come along with us, Mr. Armstrong, and I think we might be able to relieve your straits."
Chapter 21
Bloody Men.
Once they reached the trace, there were horses, mules, and wagons, as well as militia companies. Rachel was able to ride in a teamster's wagon filled with sacks of barley, Ian and Rollo trotting along beside as far as Matson's Ford, where they were meant to meet Denzel and Dotty. They waited at the ford until mid-morning, but there was no sign of Denzel's wagon, and none of the militia groups crossing there had seen him.
"He'll have had an emergency," Rachel said, lifting one shoulder in resignation. "We'd best go on by ourselves. Perhaps we can find a wagon on the main road that will carry us into the city."
She wasn't troubled. Any doctor's family was used to fending for themselves unexpectedly. And she loved being alone with Ian, talking, looking at his face. Ian agreed that this was good sense, and they splashed across, shoes in hand, the cold water a relief. Even in the forest the air was close and hot, restless with prowling thunder that never came close enough to do much good.
"Here," he said to Rachel,
and handed her his moccasins, his rifle, and his belt with powder horn, shot bag, and dirk.
"Stand back a bit, eh?"
He could see a scour in the stream bed, where a persistent eddy had carved a deep hole, a dark, inviting shadow in the ripples of the creek. He leapt from stone to stone, and jumped from the last one, going into the hole with a plunk, like a dropped boulder. Rollo, belly-deep in the ford and soaked to the shoulders, barked and showered Rachel with water from a huge wagging tail. Ian's head lunged back into view, streaming water, and he reached a long, skinny arm toward her leg, beckoning her to join him. She didn't retreat, but held his rifle out at arm's length and raised one brow, and he dropped his invitation, scrambling out of the hole on hands and knees. He stood up in the ford and shook himself like Rollo, spattering her with icy drops.
"Want to go in?"
he asked, grinning as he took back his weapons. He wiped water from his brows and chin with the back of his hand.
"It'll cool you right down."
"I would," she said, smearing the cold droplets over her sweating face with one hand. "If my clothes were as impervious to the elements as thine are." He had on his worn buckskin leggings and breech-clout, with a calico shirt so faded that the red flowers on it were nearly the same colour as the brown background. Neither water nor sun would make any difference, and he would look just the same, wet or dry, while she would look like a drowned rat all day, and an immodest drowned rat at that, shift and dress half transparent with water, and sticking to her. The casual thought coincided with Ian's buckling of his belt, and the movement drew her eye to the flap of his linen breech-clout, or rather to where it had been before he raised it to pull it over his belt. She drew in her breath audibly, and he looked up at her, surprised.
"Eh?"
"Never mind," she said, her face going hot despite the cool water. But he looked down, following the direction of her gaze, and then looked back right into her eyes, and she had a strong impulse to jump straight into the water, damage to her wardrobe notwithstanding.
"Are you bothered?"
he said, eyebrows raised, as he plucked at the wet cloth of his breech-clout, then dropped the flap.
"No," she said with dignity. I've seen one before, thee knows.
Many of them, just not...
Not one with which I'm soon to be intimately acquainted, she thought.
Just not... yours. I dinna think it's anything out of the ordinary, he assured her gravely. But you can look if you like. Just in case. I wouldna want you to be startled, I mean.
Startled? She repeated, giving him a look. If thee thinks I am under any illusions about either the object or the process, after living for months in a military camp, I doubt I shall be shocked when the occasioner...
She broke off, a moment too late.
Rises, he finished for her, grinning. I think I'll be very disappointed if you're not, Ken.
In spite of the hot blush which seemed to run from her scalp straight down into her nether regions, she didn't begrudge him fun at her expense. Anything that made him smile like that was balm to her own spirit. He'd been deeply oppressed ever since the dreadful news of the ship's sinking had come, and while he'd borne up with a stoicism she thought natural to both Highlanders and Indians, saying little about it, he hadn't tried to hide his desolation from her, either. She was glad of that, despite her own sadness for Mr. Fraser, for whom she had a deep respect and affection. She did wonder about Ian's mother and how she might have got on with that lady. At the best, she might have had a mother again herself, and that would have been a great blessing. She hadn't been expecting the best, though. She doubted that Jenny Murray would have been any more pleased at the notion of her son marrying a friend than a Quaker meeting might be to hear of Rachel's intention of marrying a man of blood, and a Catholic to boot. She wasn't sure which of those would be more cause for consternation, but was sure that Ian's tattoos would pale in contrast to his affiliation with the Pope. "How shall we be wed, do you think?" Ian, who had been walking in front of her to push branches out of her way, paused and turned to let her come alongside, the path here being wide enough to walk abreast for a little. "I don't know," she told him frankly. "I think I cannot in good conscience be baptized Catholic, no more than you in good conscience could live as a friend."
"Do friends marry only other friends, then?"
One side of his mouth curled.
"I'd think the choice might be a bit sparse. Or do you all end up marrying your cousins?"
"They marry other friends, or they get put out of meeting," she told him, ignoring the jibe about cousins. "With rare exceptions. A marriage between a friend and a non-friend might be allowed in case of dire circumstance, after a committee on clearness had conferred with both bride and groom. But it's rare. I fear that even Dorothea may have difficulty, in spite of her very evident sincerity of conversion."
Ian laughed at the thought of Denny's fiancée. Lady Dorothea Jacqueline Benedicta Grey was no one's notion of a demure Quaker. Though, for that matter, Rachel thought that anyone who supposed female friends to be demure had never met one.
"Have you asked Denny what they mean to do?"
"I haven't," she admitted. "To tell the truth, I'm somewhat afraid to ask."
Ian's feathery brows shot up.
"Afraid? Why?"
"Both on his account and ours. You know we were put out of our meeting in Virginia. Or rather he was, and I went with him. It affected him very much, and I know he wishes above all things to marry Dotty properly before the witness of a meeting to which they both belong."
Ian shot her a quick glance, and she knew he was about to ask if she felt likewise. She hurried on to forestall him.
"There are other friends in his same case, though. Men who cannot abide the thought of capitulation to the king, and who feel obliged to assist the Continental Army. Fighting Quakers, they call themselves."
She couldn't help smiling at the name. It conjured such incongruous images.
"Some such held meeting now and then at Valley Forge, but they aren't accepted by Philadelphia yearly meeting. Denny has to do with them, but hasn't joined them as yet."
"Aye."
The trail had narrowed again, and Ian moved ahead, turning his head to speak over his shoulder so she would know he attended. She was somewhat distracted herself. The buckskin was drying slowly, moulding itself damply to Ian's long, sinewy shanks, and reminding her of his breech clout.
"Yes," she said, recovering her train of thought. "The thing is he familiar with religious disputation, Ian?"
That made him laugh again.
"I had thought not," she said dryly. "I am. And the thing is, when a group of persons who disagree with a central teaching of..."
"Heretics," he offered helpfully. "Quakers wouldn't have burned folk, would they?"
"Those who are led of the spirit to follow a different path, let us say," she said a little tersely. "And no, they wouldn't. But the point I am making is that when such a group breaks away over some point of doctrine, they are inclined to cling even more rigorously to the rest of their beliefs and be more fierce even than the original group."
Ian's head lifted. So did Rollo's. Both hunters turned to and fro, nostrils flaring, but then shook themselves slightly and resumed walking.
"Aye, so?"
Ian said, reminding her of her point. "So even if Denny should become convinced that he should belong to a meeting of fighting Quakers, they might be that much more reluctant to accept a member such as Dotty. Though, on the other hand, should they be willing to do so, that might mean that they would at least consider our marriage." She tried to sound hopeful about that prospect, but in truth thought pigs might fly before any meeting of friends accepted Ian Murray, or vice versa.
"Is the attending Ian?"
she asked, a little sharply, for man and dog were still moving, but with a new wariness. Rollo's ears cocked alertly, and Ian shifted his rifle from shoulder to hand. Within a few steps, she heard what they had heard, the distant sounds of wagon wheels and marching feet. An army on the move, and the thought made the fine hairs prickle on her arms in spite of the heat.
"What?"
Ian turned a blank face toward her, then came to himself and smiled.
"Well, no. I was wondering what a dire circumstance might be. To friends?"
Rachel had wondered that herself, if only briefly.
"Well,"
she began dubiously.
In truth, she had no idea what sort of dire circumstance would make such a marriage thinkable, let alone acceptable. "I was only thinking," he went on, before she could think of anything. "Uncle Jamie told me how it was when his parents wed. His father stole his mother away from her brothers, and they were obliged to hide where they could, for the Mackenzies of Leoch weren't anything you'd want to face when roused."
His face was animated, telling the story.
"They couldn't be married in Kirk, for the bands couldn't be called, and they'd be discovered the moment they came out of hiding to speak to a priest. So they stayed hidden until Ellen, that would be my granny, aye, was big wee child, and then came out. Her brothers couldn't object to the marriage at that point, and so they were wed."
He shrugged.
"So I was only wondering... would friends think a coming child a dire circumstance?"
Rachel stared at him.
"If thee thinks that I will lie with thee without marriage, Ian Murray," she said in measured tones, "thee has no notion just how dire thy own circumstances might become."
By the time they reached the main road that led to Philadelphia, the sound had grown amazingly, and so had the traffic making it. Normally a busy road carrying travellers and wagons full of produce to and from the nearby countryside, it was all but choked now, mules braying, children shrieking, harried parents calling out for their offspring, pushing handcarts and barrows full of possessions along the road, often with a resentful pig towed alongside by a rope round its neck, or a basket of chickens wobbling atop the pile. And in... around and through the struggling knot of civilians fleeing at foot pace was the army. Marching columns, two by two, leather straps and gaiters creaking as they sweated through their coats, faces more crimson in the heat than their fading uniforms. Small platoons of cavalry, still fine on their horses, knots of green-clad Hessians, and here and there, companies of infantry stationed at the side of the road, providing support for officers who were stopping wagons, sometimes commandeering them, sometimes waving them on. Ian paused in the shadow of the trees, judging the situation. The sun was nearly overhead, plenty of time, and they had nothing that the army would want. No one would stop them. He was aware of the militia companies, too. They had met several passing through the woods. These, for the most part, stayed off the road, making their way carefully through the verges in ones and twos and threes, not hiding, but not drawing attention to themselves either.
"Look!" Rachel exclaimed, her hand tightening on his arm. "It's William!"
She pointed at a tall officer on the far side of the road and looked up at Ian, her face bright as sun on water.
"We must speak to him."
Ian's hand had tightened on her shoulder in response, and he felt the urgency of her flesh, but also the terrible fragility of the bones under it.
"Not you," he said,
and lifted his chin toward the plodding ranks of disgruntled troops, sweating and dust-stained.
"I dinna want ye anywhere in sight of them."
Her eyes narrowed just a trifle, but Ian had been married once, and took his hand off her shoulder promptly.
"I mean," he said hastily, "I'll go and talk to William. I'll bring him here to you."
Rachel opened her mouth to reply, but he snooved his way hastily through the screening bushes before she could speak.
"Stay,"
he said sternly to Rollo, turning back for an instant. The dog, who hadn't stirred from his comfortable spot at Rachel's feet, twitched one ear. William was standing by the roadside, looking hot, tired, dishevelled, and thoroughly unhappy. As well he might, Ian thought with some sympathy. He Kent William had surrendered at Saratoga. He was likely bound for England, if he was lucky, or for a long parole in some rough lodging somewhere far to the north. In either case, his active role as a soldier was over for some time. His face changed abruptly at sight of Ian. Surprise, the beginnings of indignation, then a quick glance round, decision clamping down upon his features. Ian was surprised for a moment that he could read William's face so easily, but then remembered why. Uncle Jamie guarded his own expression in company, but not with Ian. Ian's own face didn't show his knowledge, though, any more than William's now showed more than an irritable acknowledgement. "Scout," William said with the briefest of nods. The corporal, to whom he'd been talking, gave Ian a brief, incurious look, then saluted William and plunged back into the trudging stream.
"What the bloody hell do you want?"
William drew a grubby sleeve across his sweating face. Ian was mildly surprised at this evident hostility. They'd parted on good terms the last time they'd seen each other, though there had been little conversation at the time. William, having just put a pistol ball through the brain of a madman trying to kill Rachel, Ian, or both, with an axe. Ian's left arm had healed enough to dispense with a sling, but it was still stiff.
"There's a lady who'd like to speak with you," he said, ignoring William's narrowed eyes.
The eyes relaxed a little.
"Miss Hunter?"
A small gleam of pleasure lit William's eyes, and Ian's own narrowed slightly.
"Oh, well," he thought. "Let her tell him, then."
William waved to another corporal down the line, who waved back. Then he stepped off the road after Ian. A few soldiers glanced at Ian, but he was unremarkable. The double line of dotted tattooing on his cheeks, his buckskin breeches, and his sun-browned skin marking him as an Indian scout. A good many of these had deserted the British Army, but there were still a good many left, mostly loyalists like Joseph Brant, who held land in Pennsylvania and New York. There were also still some ranging parties from the Iroquois nations who had come down to fight at Saratoga.
"William!"
Rachel flew across the little clearing and clasped the tall captain's hands, beaming up at him with such joy that he smiled back at her. All irritability vanished. Ian hung back a bit to give her time.
There hadn't been any, really, what with Rollo roaring and tearing at Archbug's miserable old carcass, Rachel sprawled on the floor, frozen with horror, himself lying on the floor pouring blood, and half the street outside screaming bloody murder. William had pulled Rachel to her feet and thrust her into the arms of the first woman available, who, as it happened, was Marsali.
"Get her out of here,"
William had snapped. But Rachel, Ian's nut-brown maiden, her brownness much splattered with blood, had pulled herself together in an instant, and gritting her teeth, Ian had seen her do it, bemused by shock as he lay on the floor, watching things happen as though in a dream, had stepped over old Archer's body, fallen to her knees in the mess of brains and blood, wrapped her apron tight about Ian's wounded arm, and tied it with her kerchief, and then, with Marsali, had dragged him bodily out of the print shop and into the street, where he'd promptly passed out, waking only when Auntie Claire began stitching his arm. Ian hadn't had time to thank William, even had he been able to speak, and he meant to convey his own thanks as soon as he might. But clearly Rachel wanted to talk to him first, and he waited, thinking how beautiful she looked, her eyes the clouded hazel of thicket and greenbriar, face clever and quick as flame. "But thee is tired, William, and thin," she was saying, drawing a finger disapprovingly down the side of his face. "Do they not feed thee? I thought it was only the Continentals who went short of rations."
"Oh, I haven't had time of late."
The happiness that had lit William's face while he talked with Rachel faded noticeably.
"Well, you see."
He waved an arm toward the invisible road, where the hoarse chants of the sergeants rang like the calling of disgruntled crows above the shuffle of feet.
"I do see. Where is he going?"
William rubbed the back of his hand across his mouth and glanced at Ian.
"I suppose he oughtn't to see," Ian said, coming across and touching Rachel's arm, smiling at William in apology. "We're the enemy, an Ian Dunn."
William looked sharply at Ian, catching the tone of his voice, then back at Rachel, whose hand he was still holding.
"We are betrothed, William, Ian and I," she said, gently pulling her hand out of his and putting it on Ian's.
William's face changed abruptly, losing its look of happiness altogether. He eyed Ian with something remarkably close to dislike.
"Are you?" he said flatly. "I suppose I must wish you every happiness, then. Good day."
He turned on his heel, and Ian, surprised, reached out to pull him back.
"Wait," he said.
And then William turned and hit him in the mouth. He was lying on his back in the leaves, blinking in disbelief as Rollo huddled over him and sank his teeth into some soft part of William, judging by the yelp and the brief cry of startlement from Rachel.
"Rollo, bad dog! And thee is a bad dog too, William Ransom. What the devil does thee mean by this?"
Ian sat up, tenderly fingering his lip, which was bleeding. Rollo had retreated a little under Rachel's scolding, but kept a yellow eye fixed on William, and a curled lip raised over bared teeth, the faintest rumble of a growl coming from his huge chest.
"Furich,"
Ian said to him briefly, and got to his feet. William had sat down and was examining the calf of his leg, which was bleeding through his torn silk hose, though not badly. When he saw Ian, he scrambled to his feet. His face was bright red, and he looked as though he meant either to do murder or burst into tears.
"Maybe both," Ian thought in surprise.
He was careful not to touch William again, but stood back a bit, in front of Rachel, just in case the man meant to go off again. He was armed, after all. There was a pistol and knife at his belt.
"Are you all right, man?"
Ian asked, in the same tone of mild concern he'd heard his da use now and then on his mam or Uncle Jamie. Evidently it was, in fact, the right tone to take with a Fraser about to go berserk, for William breathed like a grampus for a moment or two, then got himself under control.
"I ask your pardon, sir," he said,
back stiff as a stick of rock maple.
"That was unforgivable. I shall leave you. Miss Hunter, I...
He turned, stumbling a little, and that gave Rachel time to dart round in front of Ian.
William, her face was full of distress. What is it? Have I...
He looked down at her, his face contorted, but shook his head.
You haven't done anything, he said, with an obvious effort. You could never do anything that...
He swung round toward Ian, fist clenched on his sword.
But you fucking bastard, you son of a bitch, cousin.
Oh, said Ian stupidly.
You knew then? Yes, I bloody know. You could have fucking told me.
Know what?
Rachel looked from him to William and back again.
Don't you bloody tell her, William snapped.
Don't be silly, Rachel said reasonably. Of course he'll tell me the minute we're alone. Does thee not wish to tell me thyself? I think perhaps he might not trust Ian to say it aright.
Her eye rested on Ian's lip, and her own mouth twitched. Ian might have taken offence at this, save that William's distress was so apparent.
But isn't he really a disgrace? He began, but then stepped hastily back as William's clenched fists drew back. You think not?
William was so furious his voice was nearly inaudible.
To discover that I am the get of a Scottish criminal, that I'm a fucking bastard.
Despite his resolve to be patient, Ian felt his own dander start to rise.
Criminal forby, he snapped. Any man might be proud to be the son of Jamie Freezer.
Oh, said Rachel, forestalling William's next heated remark. That.
What?
He glared down at her.
What the devil do you mean, that?
We thought it must be the case, Denny and I.
She lifted one shoulder, though keeping a close watch on William, who looked as if he were about to go off like a 12-pound mortar.
But we suppose that he didn't wish the matter talked about. I didn't know that the... How could they not have known? She asked curiously. The resemblance.
Fuck the resemblance.
Ian forgot Rachel and hit William on the head with a double-fisted thump that knocked him to his knees, then kicked him in the stomach. Had the kick landed where he'd meant it to, it would have finished the matter right there. But William was a good deal faster than Ian expected him to be. He twisted sideways, caught Ian's foot, and yanked. Ian hit the ground on one elbow, rolled up, and got hold of William's ear. He was dimly aware of Rachel screaming and was momentarily sorry for it, but the relief of fighting was too great to think of anything else, and she disappeared as his fury surged. There was blood in his mouth, and his ears were ringing, but he had one hand on William's throat and the other stabbing forked for his eyes, when hands seized him by the shoulders and jerked him off his cousin's squirming body. He shook his head to clear it, panting and pulling at whoever was holding him. There were two of the villains. That earned him a thump in the ribs that knocked out what little breath he had. William wasn't doing much better. He got to his feet, wiping the back of his hand under his nose, which was bleeding profusely. He glanced at the result and grimaced in disgust, wiping the hand on his coat.
Take him, he said, half breathless but in control of himself.
One of his eyes was swelling shut, but the other gave Ian a look of straightforward bloodlust. And despite the circumstances, Ian was once more startled at seeing one of Uncle Jamie's expressions on another face. There was a thunderous growl from Rollo. Rachel had the big dog's scruff twisted tight, but Ian kent well enough that she couldn't hold him if he decided to savage William.
"Furi ahoy,"
he said, with all the authority he could summon. The soldiers would kill Rollo without second thought if he lunged for William's throat. The dog eased back down on his haunches but stayed tensed, his lips drawn back from saliva-dripping fangs, and a deep, constant growl echoing through his body. William glanced at Rollo, then turned his back on the dog. He sniffed, hawked, and spat blood to one side, then continued, still breathing heavily.
"Take him to the head of the column, to Colonel Prescott. He's under arrest for assaulting an officer. He'll be dealt with at camp this evening."
"What does thee mean, dealt with?"
Rachel demanded, pushing her way past the two soldiers holding Ian.
"And how dare thee, William Ransom? How dare thee?"
She was white-faced with fury, small fists clenched and shaking at her sides. And Ian grinned at her, licking fresh blood from his split lip. She was paying no attention to him, though, all her ire focused on William, who drew himself up to his full height and glared down the steep bridge of his nose at her. "This is no longer your concern, madam," he said, as coldly as a man who was as red as a piece of flannel and shooting sparks out of his ears could manage. Ian thought Rachel might actually kick William in the shins, and would have paid good money to see that. But her Quaker principles got the better of the situation, and she drew herself up to her own not insignificant height, she was as tall as Auntie Claire, and thrust her chin pugnaciously up at William. "Thee is a coward and a brute," she declared at the top of her voice. Swinging round toward the men holding Ian, she added, "And so are you brutes and cowards to be following an order so lacking in justice." One of the soldiers sniggered, then coughed as he caught William's bloodshot eye upon him.
"Take him," William repeated.
"Now." And turning on his heel, stalked off. There was a broad stripe of pale road dust down the back of his coat, and a good deal of it in his hair.
"Best bugger off, miss,"
one of the soldiers advised Rachel, not unkindly.
"You don't want to be down amongst the troops, like. Not on your own."
"I will not bugger off," Rachel said, narrowing her eyes at the man in a way that reminded Ian of a panther about to spring. "What does thee intend to do to this man?" She gestured at Ian, who was getting his own breath back by now.
"Rachel," he began,
but was interrupted by the other soldier.
"Assaulting an officer? Probably 500 lashes. Wouldn't hang him, I don't suppose,"
the man added dispassionately.
"Seeing as young Galahad's not maimed, I mean."
Rachel went even whiter at this, and Ian jerked hard at his arms, getting his feet solidly under him.
"It'll be all right, then, Ian," he said,
hoping he sounded reassuring.
"Rollo, Furich.
But he's right. The camp's nae place for you, and you canna do me any good by coming. Go back to the city, aye? Tell Auntie Claire what's happened. She can speak to..."
A third soldier coming out of nowhere had hit him in the pit of the stomach with a musket butt.
"What are you lot hanging about for? Get on. And you..."
The soldier turned on Rachel and the dog, glowering.
"Shoo."
He jerked his head at Ian's captors, who obligingly hauled Ian around. Ian tried to turn his head to give Rachel a final word, but they jerked him back and firmly down the road. He stumbled along in preference to being dragged, thinking furiously Auntie Claire was his best chance, likely his only one. If she could make Lord John take a hand, either speaking to Willie or directly to this Colonel Prescott. He glanced up at the sun. Noon, more or less. And the British on the march carried out routine flogging and other punishment after the evening meal. He'd seen it now and then. And he'd seen his uncle's back now and then, too. A cold worm crawled through his sore belly.
6 hours. Maybe.
He risked another quick glance back. Rachel was running, Rollo loping alongside. William swabbed his face with what was left of his handkerchief. His features felt foreign to him, lumped and swollen, and he explored the inside of his mouth gingerly with his tongue. No teeth missing, a couple maybe loose, and a stinging cut inside his cheek. Not bad. He thought he'd done worse to Murray, and was glad of it. He was still trembling, not with shock, but with the urge to rip someone limb from limb. At the same time, he was beginning to feel shock, though conscious thought still came in fleeting snatches. What the devil had he done? A short column of soldiers marched past, a few of them openly staring at him. He gave them a vicious look, and their heads snapped forward so fast he could hear the leather of their stocks creak. He hadn't done it. Murray had attacked him. Where did Rachel Hunter get off calling him a coward and a brute? He felt the trickle of blood crawling down from one nostril and staunched it, snorting into the filthy rag. He saw someone approaching, coming up the road accompanied by a large dog. He straightened, stuffing the handkerchief into his pocket. "Speak of the bloody she-devil," he muttered, and coughed, his throat raw with the iron taste of blood. Rachel Hunter was pale with rage. Apparently she hadn't turned round to apologise for her insults. She had snatched off her cap and held it clutched in one hand. Did she mean to throw it at him? He wondered in fogged amazement.
"Miss Hunter,"
he began in a rasping voice, and would have bowed, save he was afraid the motion would make his nose bleed again.
"They cannot mean it, William."
"Mean what?" he said.
And she gave him a look that might have singed the small hairs off his body, had he not still been hot himself.
"Do not be obtuse," she snapped. "What possessed thee to—"
"What possessed your fiancé?" he snapped back. "Did I attack him? No."
"Yes, you did. You struck him in the mouth without the slightest provocation."
"And he hit me on the head without the least warning. If anyone is a coward—"
"Don't you dare call Ian Murray coward, you...
I'll call him what I bloody like. What he bloody is. Just like his goddamned uncle, goddamned Scottish bastard I mean...
"His uncle? Thy father?"
"Shut up," he bellowed,
and felt the blood surge into his face, stinging all the raw places.
"Don't call him my father."
She breathed stertorously through her nose for a moment, glaring up at him.
"If thee allow this to be done, William Ransom, I will...
William could feel the blood pool in his belly and thought he might faint, but not because of her threats.
"He'll what?" he asked, half breathless.
"You're a Quaker. You don't believe in violence. Ergo, you can't, or at least won't," he corrected himself, seeing the dangerous look in her eye, "stab me. You probably won't even strike me. So what did you have in mind?"
She did strike him. Her hand whipped out like a snake and slapped him across the face hard enough to make him stagger.
"So, now thee has doomed Ian, repudiated thy father, and caused me to betray my principles. What next?"
"Oh, bloody hell," he said,
and grabbed her arms, pulled her roughly to him, and kissed her. He let go and stepped back quickly, leaving her bug-eyed and gasping. The dog growled at him. She glared at him, spat on the ground at his feet, then wiped her lips on her sleeve and, turning away, marched off, the dog at her heels, casting a red-eyed look at William.
"Is spitting on people a part of your bloody principles?" he shouted after her.
She swung round, fists clenched at her sides.
"Is assaulting women part of yours?" she bellowed back,
to the amusement of the infantrymen who had been standing still by the road, leaning on their weapons and gaping at the show provided. Flinging her cap on the ground at his feet, she whirled on her heel and stamped away before he could say more. Jamie caught sight of a small group of redcoats coming down the road and slumped on the wagon's seat, hat pulled down over his eyes. No one would be looking for him with the British Army on the move, and even were he recognised, probably no one would bother trying to detain or question him in the midst of such an exodus. But the sight of British soldiers would likely put a knot in his tailbone for the rest of his life, and today was no exception. He turned his head casually away toward the far side of the road as the soldiers passed, but then heard a loud "Hissen!" in a very familiar voice, and jerked round in reflex to find himself staring straight into his nephew Ian's startled, horrified face. He was equally startled, and nearly as horrified, to see Ian. Hands tied behind his back, smeared with dirt and blood, and obviously the worse for wear, being shoved along by two cross-looking British privates, red-faced and sweating in their heavy uniforms. He stifled his immediate urge to leap off the wagon and stared hard at Ian, willing the lad not to speak. He didn't, just goggled back with his eyes bulging out of his head and his face pale as though he'd seen a ghost, and walked past, speechless.
"Jesus," Jamie murmured under his breath, realizing. "He thinks he has seen my fetch." "Who thinks what?" asked the driver, though without much interest. "I think I must get down here, sir, if you'd be so civil as to stop." "Aye, thanks."
Without thought of his back, he swung down off the wagon. It twinged, but there was no warning stab of pain down his leg. And if there had been, he would still have gone up the road as fast as he could, because he saw a small figure a little way ahead, running like a rabbit with its tail on fire. The figure was plainly female. It was accompanied by a large dog, and he had the sudden thought that it might be Rachel Hunter. It was, and he just managed to catch her up, seizing her by the arm as she ran, petticoats curled up in her arms and feet hammering the dust.
"Come with me, lass," he said urgently, grabbed her around the waist, and pulled her off the road.
She uttered a stifled shriek, and then a much louder one when she looked up and saw his face.
"No, I'm not dead," he said hurriedly. "Later, I. Step back on the road with me now, or someone's going to come and see am I raping you in the bushes." "Kimera a hau a hoin," he added to Rollo, who was sniffing him industriously.
She made an odd gargling noise in her throat and continued to stare, but after an instant blinked and nodded, and they were back on the road. Jamie smiled and acknowledged a man who had stopped in the middle of the road, dropping the handles of a barrow he was trundling. The man looked suspiciously at them, but Rachel, after a moment's stunned bewilderment, waved at him with a ghastly smile, and he shrugged and picked up his barrow.
What? She croaked.
She looked as though she might collapse or vomit, chest heaving and her face going scarlet and white and scarlet again. She'd lost her cap, and her dark hair was matted with sweat and sticking to her face.
"Later," he said again, but gently. "What's happened to Ian? Where are they taking him?"
Between wrenching gasps, she told him what had happened.
"Avec un Gilles," he said softly,
and wondered for a split second what or who he meant by that. The thought vanished, though, as he looked up at the road. Perhaps a quarter mile back, he could see the large, slow-moving knot of evacuees, a sprawling mass of slow wagons and trudging people, with the neat scarlet columns of soldiers splitting to flow round them. Coming on now, four abreast.
"Aye, then," he said grimly, and touched Rachel's shoulder. "Dinna fash, lassie. Get your breath and go back after Ian, but dinna get close enough that the soldiers take notice of you. When he's free, tell him the two of you must come back to the city straight away. Go to the print shop. Oh, and best leash the hound wi' your sash. You dinna want him to eat anyone."
"Free? But what... what are you going to do?"
She'd got the hair out of her eyes and was calmer, though the whites of her eyes still showed all round. She reminded him of a young badger at bay, baring its teeth in panic, and the thought made him smile a little.
"I mean to have a word with my son," he said,
and leaving her, strode purposefully up the road. He made out William at a considerable distance. The young man was standing at the side of the road, bareheaded, dishevelled, and slightly battered, but evidently attempting to look collected. His hands were folded behind his back, and he appeared to be counting the wagons that passed him. He was alone, and Jamie hastened his step to reach the lad before anyone came along to talk to him. He needed privacy for his own conversation. He was reasonably sure Rachel hadn't told him everything about the recent stramash, and wondered whether she herself had been partly the cause of it. She had said the trouble began just after she told William about her betrothal to Ian. Her account had been slightly confused overall, but he'd got the gist of it well enough, and his jaw tightened as he came up to William and saw the look on his face.
"Christ, do I look like that in a temper?" he wondered briefly.
It was off-putting to speak to a man who looked as though he asked nothing more of the world than the chance to rend someone limb from limb and dance on the pieces.
"Well, rend away, lad," he said under his breath, "and we'll see who dances."
He stepped up beside William and took off his hat.
"You,"
he said baldly, not wishing to call the lad by either title or name.
"Come aside with me. Now."
The look on William's face changed from incipient murder to the same look of startled horror Jamie had just surprised on Ian's. Had matters been otherwise, he'd have laughed. As it was, he gripped William hard by the upper arm, pushed him off balance, and had him into the shelter of a scrim of saplings before he could set his feet hard.
"You!" William blurted, wrenching loose. "What the devil are you doing here? And where is my... What have you..."
He made a convulsive gesture of dismissal.
"What are you doing here?"
"Talking to you, if you'll close your mouth for a moment," Jamie said coldly. "Listen to me, lad, because I'm telling you what you're going to do."
"You're not telling me anything," William began furiously, and cocked a fist.
Jamie grabbed him by the upper arm again, and this time dug his fingers hard into the spot Claire had shown him, on the underside of the bone. William let out a strangled, "Ah!" and started to pant, his eyes bulging.
"You're going to catch up with the men you sent Ian with and tell them to set him free," Jamie said evenly. "If you don't, I go down under a flag of truce to the camp where they're taking him, introduce myself, tell the commander who you are, and explain the reason for the fight. You'll be right there beside me. Do I make myself clear?" he asked, increasing the pressure of his fingers.
"Yes."
The word came out in a hiss, and Jamie let go suddenly, folding his fingers into a fist to hide the fact that they were trembling and twitching from the effort.
"God damn you, sir," William whispered, and his eyes were black with violence. "God damn you to hell."
His arm hung limp and must have hurt, but he wouldn't rub it, not with Jamie watching. Jamie nodded.
"Ne doute," he said quietly,
and went into the forest. Once out of sight of the road, he leaned against a tree, feeling sweat stream down his face. His back felt cast in cement. His whole body was trembling, but he hoped that William had been too distrait to notice.
"God, should it have come to blows? I couldn't have taken him."
He closed his eyes and listened to his heart, which was thumping like a boron. After a little, he heard the sound of hooves on the road, a horse galloping, and turning to peer through the trees, caught a glimpse of William thundering past, heading in the direction Ian had been taken. Chapter 22. The Gathering Storm. By breakfast on Thursday, I'd come to the firm conclusion that it was the Duke of Pardlow or me. If I stayed in the house, only one of us would remain alive by sundown. Denzel Hunter must have come into the city by now, I reasoned. He'd call in daily at Mrs. Woodcock's house, where Henry Gray was convalescing. A very kind and capable doctor, he could easily manage Hal's recovery, and perhaps his future father-in-law would be grateful for his professional attention. The thought made me laugh out loud, despite my increasing anxiety. "To Dr. Denzel Hunter, from Dr. C.B.R. Fraser. I'm called away to King Sessing for the day. I surrender His Grace the Duke of Pardlow to your most competent care, in the happy confidence that your religious scruples will prevent your striking him in the head with an axe. Yours most sincerely, C. Postscriptum. I'll bring you back some asafoetida and ginseng root as recompense. Postscriptum. Strongly suggest you don't bring Dottie, unless you possess a pair of manacles. Preferably two." I sanded this missive, gave it to Colenso for delivery to Mrs. Woodcock's house, and executed a quiet sneak out the front door before Jenny or Mrs. Fig should pop up and demand to know where I was going. It was barely 7 o'clock, but the air was already warming, gradually heating up the city. By noon, the pungent mix of animals, humans, sewage, rotting vegetable matter, resinous trees, river mud, and hot brick would be stifling. But for the moment, the faint scent lent a piquant touch to the gentle air. I was tempted to walk, but even my most utilitarian shoes weren't up to an hour's walk on country roads, and if I waited for sundown and the cooling evening to make my way back, I'd be remarkably late. Neither was it a good idea for a woman to be alone on the roads, on foot, day or night. I thought I could manage the 3 blocks to the livery stable without incident, but at a corner of Walnut, I was hailed by a familiar voice from a carriage window.
Mrs. Fraser. I say, Mrs. Fraser.
I looked up, startled, to see the hawk-nosed face of Benedict Arnold smiling down at me. His normally fleshy features were gaunt and lined, and his usually ruddy complexion had faded to an indoor pallor, but there was no mistaking him. Oh, I said, and made a quick bob. How nice to see you, General. My heart had sped up. I'd heard from Denny Hunter that Arnold had been appointed military governor of Philadelphia, but hadn't expected to see him so soon, if at all. I should have left it there, but couldn't help asking, "How's the leg?" I knew he'd been badly injured at Saratoga, shot in the same leg that had been wounded a short time before, and then crushed by his horse, falling with him in the storming of Bremen Redoubt. But I hadn't seen him then. The regular army surgeons had attended him, and from what I knew of their work, I was rather surprised that he was not only alive, but still had 2 legs. His face clouded a bit at that, but he continued to smile.
"Still present, Mrs. Fraser, if 2 inches shorter than the other. Where are you going this morning?"
He glanced automatically behind me, registering my lack of a maid or companion, but didn't seem disturbed by it. He'd met me on the battlefield and knew me, and appreciated me for what I was. I knew what he was, too, and what he would become. The hell of it was that I liked the man. "Ah, I'm on my way out to King Sessing."
"On foot?"
His mouth twitched. "Actually, I had it in mind to hire a gig from the livery stable." I nodded in the general direction of Davison's stable. "Just round the corner there. Lovely to see you, General."
"Wait a moment, Mrs. Fraser, if you would."
He turned his head towards his aide, who was leaning over his shoulder, nodding toward me and saying something inaudible. Next thing I knew, the carriage door popped open and the aide jumped down, offering me an arm.
"Do come up, Mom."
"But..."
"Captain Evans here says the livery is closed, Mrs. Fraser. Allow me to put my carriage at your service."
"But..."
Before I could think of anything to complete this protest, I was handed up opposite the general and the door firmly shut, Captain Evans hopping nimbly up beside the driver. "I gather that Mr. Davison was a loyalist," General Arnold said, eyeing me.
"Was?" I said, rather alarmed. "What happened to him?"
"Captain Evans says that Davison and his family have left the city."
They had. The carriage had turned into 5th Street, and I could see the livery stable, its doors hanging open, one of them pulled entirely off, and lying in the street. The stable was empty, as was the stable yard, the wagon, the gig, and the small coach gone with the horses, sold or stolen. From the Davison's house, next to the stable, the tatters of Mrs. Davison's lace curtains fluttered limp in a broken window. "Oh," I said, and swallowed. I darted a quick look at General Arnold. He'd called me Mrs. Fraser. Obviously he didn't know what my current situation was, and I couldn't make up my mind whether to tell him. On impulse, I decided not to. The less official inquiry there was into events at No. 17 Chestnut Street, the better, whether the inquiry was British or American.
"I'm told the British kept quite a clamp on Whigs in the city," he went on, looking me over with interest. "I hope you weren't much troubled, you and the Colonel."
"Oh, no," I said. "Not really." I took a deep breath, groping for some means of diverting the conversation. "But I have been rather short of news. American news, I mean. Have there been any remarkable developments of late?" He laughed at that, but wryly.
"Where shall I start, madam?"
Despite my unease,